This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. From 1931 to 1964, the research vessel Atlantis literally sailed the seas in service to Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution and, at times, the Navy. Atlantis was the Oceanographic's first research ship and the first American vessel built specifically for ocean research. She became the namesake of subsequent research ships Atlantis and Atlantis II, as well as the space shuttle Atlantis. Parts of Atlantis today continue to serve scientists in Argentina under the new name Dr. Bernardo A. Houssay. The Atlantis left a rich scientific legacy, and the stories of the founding fathers of Woods Hole who sailed aboard her live on in multiple books. But scientists weren't the only people who sailed on Atlantis. I'm referring, of course, to the crew who actually did the sailing, who got Atlantis and her scientific passengers and cargo where they needed to be. Now a new book reveals what life was like for an ordinary seaman aboard the Atlantis. Arthur Gaines and Jay Burnett are the editors of Atlantis Stories, Before the Mast on a Sailing Research Vessel. They join me now. Arthur Gaines, Jay Burnett, welcome to Living Lab.
Thank you.
Thanks, Heather.
Arthur, you have a particularly personal connection, not only to this book, but to Bill Cooper, the person whose life is portrayed in the book. Tell us how this whole project came about.
Well, the story goes back about 35 years or so. You know, for most of my 40-year marriage to Jennifer, she's been in the habit of bringing home broken furniture. And when I was off on a cruise in the late 70s, she came home with a broken boat. And working on the boat was not intimidating to me. I grew up in the Western Long Island Sound and hung around boat yards. And so the idea of working on a boat was not challenging, but it turned out this was a Herreshoff 12.5 footer.
Oh, beautiful boat.
Absolutely. and it needed a lot of work, and that was really one stage beyond me. So I found my way through various channels to a small boat yard in Gunning Point in Falmouth, and it was run by Bill Cooper, who at the time, I guess, was probably in his early 50s. And I was surprised that he was very patient with me. He explained what I needed to do to fix this boat. He showed me how to steam frames, how to replace canvas decks, things like that. And it turned out we ended up building a house near there on Gunning Point. And so for many years, we lived in proximity. And I would join some of his evening classes on seamanship, especially marlin spike seamanship and boat building. And so I got to know Bill and his family, five children, and his wife, Judy. And so when he died in 2011, his wife, Judy, brought this loose-leaf notebook to us and said, you might be interested in reading this. These are some of Bill's memoirs. So I did read it, and it was absolutely remarkable. You know, here's a fellow, Bill Cooper, who never graduated from high school, and he wrote beautifully. And his mind, his memories of his time on Atlantis from 1944 to 1948 were absolutely sharp. He remembered details that were fascinating. And so we went to the Historical Society, the Historical Museum, and they said they would like to publish it. And that got us going.
Jay Burnett, you are a fisheries researcher, or were for almost 30 years a fisheries researcher. You've been to sea on research vessels, of course, not on the Atlantis, much more recently than that. How did you get involved in this project?
Well, I was on the steering committee of the Historical Museum at the time, and we parse out these projects, and that sounded like something I'd be very interested in. So Arthur, I believe, got all the handwritten and then typed up by Judy Cooper sections together and had them scanned. And we started with that.
Now, Arthur, let's go back to the beginning of Bill Cooper's life. He was born in Brooklyn, New York, 1927, had what seemed like a pretty tough childhood. I mean, his mother died when he was a toddler. It was not like he was from a wealthy family. Where did his love of the sea, growing up in Brooklyn, New York, where did his love of the sea and this dream of going to sea come from?
Well, of course, Brooklyn is on New York Harbor. And as a child, his father would bring him to the harbor's edge. And he saw some of the great ocean liners of those days coming into the harbor, including the Normandy and other luxury liners. But I think one of the things that influenced him was, either he read the book, the Kipling book, Captain's Courageous, or he saw the 1937 movie with Spencer Tracy. But it seemed to resonate with something in his soul. And from then on, he wanted to go to sea and he wanted to be near the water.
But it took him he was still fairly young when he did eventually get hired onto Atlantis. But it took him a while to get there. And, I mean, he had this kind of roundabout path, I guess, as many people do, where actually when he was 16, he ended up working on a ranch in upstate New York. How did he end up on this ranch? And then how did that get him to Cape Cod and to life on the sea?
Sure. Well, Bill's son, Douglas, wrote the preface to this book, and he gives some detail about his father's early life. And as you say, his mother had tuberculosis, probably when she got here from Ireland. And she died before he could remember her. He may have remembered photos of her. But when he was very young, I believe Douglas said maybe 2 years old, he fell and cut his knee badly as a toddler.
And, I mean, to say that he cut his knee badly, the story, they removed a chunk of his knee. He was left permanently handicapped, and he spent 2 years in hospital. I mean, I can't even imagine 2 years in the hospital recovering from this.
It's incredible. But, you know, he was so young that when he got out, he would have been four. And all of our earliest memories come from the age of four or maybe three. So I'm not sure he remembered that, the horror of that. But it is true that the doctors feared he had tuberculosis, and they wanted to make sure that didn't spread. So he removed his knee joint, and he had an impaired leg for the rest of his life. But, you know, you mentioned the word handicap. He never thought himself handicapped, and neither did his son or his friends. He had an impaired leg, but he was able to do most things that anyone can do. But that is, in a way, one of the sub-themes of this book, how a person with a significant impairment overlooked that and proceeded on with what he wanted to do.
I mean, Jay Burnett, you're sitting here nodding your head as he says he never thought of himself as handicapped in the stories throughout the book. I mean, he's going up in a bosun's chair to the top of a 150-foot mast. Just the sheer fact that he's out on a sailing vessel in the middle of the ocean, and then to stop and remember, oh, wait, one of his legs didn't bend at the knee and was 6 inches shorter than his other leg. I mean, that never seems to enter his psyche or his accounts of anything or impede anything that he did, or even for that matter, change his interactions with people. It's really quite remarkable what a non-issue it is.
Absolutely. What you're saying is absolutely true. When he was 16, his father remarried, and she decided Bill had to go. So he was sort of pushed out of the house. And as Douglas says, he was motherless already, and with this event, moving to a ranch in New York State, he became, for all practical purposes, fatherless as well. But then he came to Cape Cod with some girls who also worked on this ranch, and they made their way to Provincetown, which is where they all thought the heart of Cape Cod was. And the story really starts when one of the girls found a place in Falmouth. It was the Cape Cod Hotel that was looking to hire people.
Right.
And Bill followed that up, and the story goes from there.
Now, Jay, you are actually going to read, because there's a little bit of a twisted path that he takes from meeting the owner of the Cape Codder, being hired on as a cabin boy for that person's private yacht, but then making his way a few months later to actually being hired by Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution to work on the Atlantis. And that's when he says, you know, all of these adventures he's already had and mishaps and drama in his life, that being hired onto the Atlantis was when real life began.
Sure. I'd like to read a little bit in the opening. In mid-April 1944, I found myself at 17 years of age traveling down east to Maine from Falmouth, Massachusetts, in a station with John Peterson, who was the owner of the Cape Codder, and Bob Tilton, who was a renowned striped bass fishing guide. Our destination was Thomaston, where Mr. Peterson had a small schooner which he had purchased earlier that spring being put in commission. I rode in the back seat of the station wagon with a 6-cylinder Chrysler Marine engine. We had left the Cape early in the morning, And after clearing Boston, we worked our way down east along Old Route 1, probably the only good road to Maine in those days. I had never been any farther than 100 miles or so from where I had been born in Brooklyn, New York. I realized that it was during that ride from Falmouth to Thomaston that my real life began.
I mean, there's a few things in there that are just truly remarkable. First of all, it's the fact that 50 years later, his memory of details, and we should say this whole book is essentially a compilation of Bill Cooper's own reminiscences that he wrote down himself. You guys put them together and added some other sidebars and historical information. But the bulk of it is his own writing, and it's incredibly detailed. And the other thing that really struck me was the fact that, you know, as we've kind of talked about, he grew up in New York City. No family connection to seagoing or to scientific research, to sailing, to any of these things. And yet he has this incredible drive and fearlessness to, you know, just at the drop of a hat, essentially sign on to go work on someone's schooner, to drive farther than he's ever driven from home on this idea that somehow he will get out to sea.
Absolutely. It's amazing how many points in his story, a happenstance occurrence, a totally serendipitous situation changes not only the direction of his life, but the direction of the people he met, the direction of the institution, for that matter. Unplanned events are so important in the outcome of his life, and it's sort of an illustration for all of us, the importance of seemingly trivial decisions will redirect the course of our whole life.
When he got hired onto the Atlantis, it was after essentially spending just one summer sailing this schooner, hanging out in Quissett Harbor here in Falmouth. He had very little experience. I was shocked that he managed to get hired as an ordinary seaman onto the Atlantis. Was he ever surprised? Did he ever say that he was surprised that he managed to get that job?
Absolutely. He left Peterson's schooner, the Sagatchet, because the boat was sold and was going to return to Maine, and he decided he'd already been captured emotionally by Quissett Harbor, so he didn't want to leave Quissett. Somebody suggested he go down to the Oceanographic because they were hiring people to work on some of their boats, and he went down with no expectation. So he was amazed when John Churchill, who was the marine superintendent then, told him to report to the Atlantis. He thought he'd go on one of the much smaller boats.
And we should say this is 1944,
war.
World War II. That had to play into it. I mean, there was a major shortage of available men to operate these ships at that time. If they were able to, they were off serving in the war. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's absolutely true. And the putting him together with these Scandinavian seamen who were superlative seamen. These are guys who were old enough to be his father or even his grandfather. These are guys who had sailed around Cape Horn on square riggers, the North Atlantic in wintertime. And all of them got jobs here because the younger men were captured by the war effort.
Well, and he had a nickname for those Scandinavian seamen, which you note in the book he uses throughout and would never have in any way considered to be derogatory, as much as it doesn't necessarily sound terribly complimentary. So tell us about the nickname for these guys.
Well, they called them squarehead sailors, and it wasn't just his name. I mean, that's a term that's still in use, and it referred to Scandinavian seamen, which he regarded as the term as an honorific or a, you know, he highly respected these guys. They were his teachers. They taught him everything, including how to behave on board ship. They were very supportive to him, and he in no way intended it as a pejorative. But, you know, some of the people who read through the manuscript before the book came out suggested we should delete that term. And both Jay and I agreed we're not going to rewrite history. Bill used the term in a way that had a meaning for him, and we would like to continue projecting that meaning as he did.
It was kind of fun for me going through. I mean, in addition to squarehead, they still used the term limey, which, you know, dates back centuries, I think, in nautical history. But he introduces some of these other terms, nautical slang, that I guess somehow seemed, you know, we said this is in the 1940s, somehow seemed even older than that. And this really seemed like it was a real transition time, politically and in terms of, you know, locally and in just in this story, how the ships were operated, who was running them, what the focus of the institution was, but also globally. This was a real time of change, and that seemed to come through in some of Bill's writings.
It really did. And, you know, the term seemed old-fashioned because he learned from people whose heyday was the early 1900s, people who had sailed square riggers around Cape Horn to Australia, to South America, and back to Hamburg, Germany, mainly German-operated ships. Your statement about transition is absolutely true. The whole country went through a transition. It was amazing in rereading this. I mean, both Jay and I were born after World War II, but the impact that war had on rearranging the power and the economy of the entire world, and everybody in the country, whether they served in active duty or not, was affected by that. Everyone in the world was affected by that war. So the book contains a number of things in it that are educational and to us as well, in thinking back about what we know about history and how the country has changed over the years.
A little bit of insight from one small part of history.
Absolutely.
You're listening to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. My guests today are Arthur Gaines and Jay Burnett, the editors of a new book, Atlantis Stories. We'll talk more about the Atlantis, the ship itself, its role in World War II, and Bill Cooper's role in all of that after a short break. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. My guests today are Jay Burnett and Arthur Gaines. Together, they're the editors of a new book, Atlantis Stories, Before the Mast on a Sailing Research Vessel. It tells the story of Bill Cooper, who spent 4 years at the end of World War II as an ordinary seaman on Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution's first research ship, the Atlantis. Let's talk a little bit about the ship itself. She was a pretty remarkable ship at the time that she was built, the largest ketch in the world. It built overseas specifically for ocean research, and the whole design of the ship, and even just the rig of the ship being a ketch, was, I guess, specific to making sure that this ship was well suited for ocean research. Let's talk a little bit about what actually went into building and designing Atlantis.
Okay. I should say right up front, though, that although Jay and I have been through this manuscript many times, and all of what we know about Atlantis really is from Bill's recollections, like any topic that you talk about in Woods Hole, you're apt to be talking about something that people in the audience know more about than you do. And in this case, Mike Palmieri, for example, who lives in Falmouth, sailed aboard Atlantis, and it was after Cooper, but he knew all about the ship. And in fact, he went through the manuscript with us and made some corrections in our labels and our photographs. He, for example, found photographs that were in backwards. And Paul Howland is another one who's local and still around. John Libby, Dick Dimmock, Redwood Wright sailed on Atlantis. So all of those people know more about the ship than we do, but she was designed as the first oceanographic research vessel. There were other vessels out there that had conducted oceanographic work, but they weren't designed for that purpose. She was built by, Burmeister and Wayne in Denmark, and in 1930-31. She was designed as a catch because that was regarded as a ship that could be hove to easily.
And I have to say, I read that and went, oh, yeah, I actually am a bit of a sailor myself. And one of my parents' first boats was a catch. And one of the things we always loved was the fact that you could, for one, you could balance the front and the aft sails so that you could basically take your hands off the wheel and it would just sail itself. And then, yeah, you can set those sails so that you just stop. And
that's
so
it was
interesting to see that was part of the considerations for a ship that would be good for research.
Major consideration. And when they first built the ship, they didn't plan on government support or naval support. This was built as an academic research vessel, principally for scientists from Harvard and elsewhere. But it was interesting to me to hear what the Scandinavian sailors said about that. They thought she should have been a schooner. They thought a schooner would have been a better rig. And a schooner also has many possible configurations of sail to heave to. But that was an interesting point as well.
I guess part of what was interesting was that perhaps it was designed, from the perspective of what we want to do for science, but not necessarily from the perspective of what that would mean for the crew who had to actually sail the boat. And she was apparently kind of a tough boat to handle, and they carried a very small crew. They needed to have really able guys. And I want to go back to these Scandinavian sailors who really taught Bill Cooper a huge amount and kept this ship at her best at all times. Jay, you pulled out another excerpt you wanted to read about one of those sailors.
Well, I actually have two short passages on two sailors. The first one is about Ernest Siverson, a squarehead, was the bosun of Atlantis at this period in 1945. He was a real old shellback in every sense of the word. When I served under him, he was about 65 years old and had been 50 years or more at sea. All the old sailors and officers had a great deal of respect for him. I don't believe there was anything about the ship he did not know. Ernest was born in Sweden about 1880. He never said anything at all about his family or home life. Once he went to sea, he never went home again. This was common of many of the older squarehead seamen. He shipped out as a boy of 14 on a German four-masted bark. Life was very hard for boys on German ships in those days. He told me that they were told only twice the names and locations of many halyards, braces, lifts, bunt lines, and other rigging. And after that, the officers kicked and beat you if you did not know.
I mean, he learned that, from these older sailors, how hard life was. It seems like he felt like maybe he had an easier learning curve, but it was still a pretty fast transition for Bill Cooper to learn everything that he needed to learn aboard the Atlantis.
Well, I think what you're saying is true. I think what he learned especially was that he knew he had had a hard time growing up, and he may have thought that most people had it easy, but what these old squarehead sailors taught him was that they all had a hard time growing up. They left home early. They had horrible experiences on board these sailing ships. And so I think that helped Bill realize that he can move ahead. He doesn't have to be handicapped by his background. He can just, as these guys have, work his way through it.
There was actually an instance where Bill defied an order from Ernest, and Ernest immediately came over and knocked him down with his fist. And that was just, Bill accepted that. He disobeyed. He deserved his...
Yeah, I mean, in his writing about that incident, he was knocked flat on the ground for simply saying, just a minute, I'll get to that in just a minute. Mm-hmm. And there's no hostility. He doesn't seem to, hold that as anything other than what it should have been, which today seems quite shocking.
Well, it was shocking then to some of the crew members who had never seen this before, but it wasn't to squarehead sailors. That's how they grew up. And one of them, Bill, in one instance said to Ernest Siverson, it must have been exciting sailing around Cape Horn in those big square riggers. And Siverson said, you think it was exciting? If I had a son, I would rather kill him with my own hands than have him suffer the way I did on those ships. So they had a tough time.
Now, I mentioned the quick learning curve. When Bill Cooper signed on to be a part of the crew of the Atlantis, seems like within a matter of weeks, the Atlantis, still here in Woods Hole, just barely essentially out of mothballs for almost 2 years down in the Gulf of Mexico, is back up here, and they get hit with an enormous hurricane. And he's got almost no experience on this boat, and yet ends up, it sounds like from his account, almost saving the ship, running around, closing ports to keep water from flowing in. It's quite an astounding story. And again, how much, to me, I guess it was amazing that with that little experience, he would be on the ship, go through that experience, and still want to sail aboard the ship. I mean, he was not at all deterred.
That's right. Cooper reveals for the first time many things that we never knew before. The director of the institution at the time was Columbus Islin. He knew he had to paint a positive picture, and so he depicted the ship drifting bare poles across Great Harbor under the command of Captain Lambert Knight. basically, you know, headed for a place Lambert thought that were no boulders was safe to let the ship run aground. But the fact is it was chaotic, and Cooper did close portholes that never should have been opened under those circumstances. He may have saved the ship, as you say.
I mean, it gave his portrayal of it gave, a sense of mayhem, of almost lackadaisical oversight on the part of the more senior crew. It was really pretty shocking. And actually, these stories come up multiple times where it's not always clear that those in charge really knew exactly what they were supposed to be doing.
I think most of the crew thought that the threat of this hurricane was overstated. And
of course, they didn't have the same kind of forecast we have now. I mean, we have to say that, right? They were going on very little information.
That's true. But, you know, I think even now, we don't have very firm information to make big decisions on until a day or so before the storm. We see them coming. We see them developing. But in my experience, the last few hurricanes we've had, we didn't have enough information about them, for example, to justify pulling all of the floating docks out of a marina or something like that. And so they had a serious warning in time to get ready, and they did what they thought was needed to get ready, but it wasn't adequate, and the ship broke loose.
As I said, he was still completely undeterred by this, and Bill Cooper seems to have fallen in love with Atlantis on site, essentially. I mean, how much of it was a love of the boat? How much of it was just this romantic notion of he was going to sea? And how much of it was the fact that despite the fact that apparently the Oceanographic was paying lower wages than perhaps other groups or organizations that were running boats, he found the wages to just be amazing. He was how much of a draw was the money?
I don't think it was any draw at all. Mm-hmm. He was amazed he'd been hired. And, you know, some of the answer to some of your question really requires going inside Bill's head. And his wife, Judy, and sons and daughter-in-law would know more about answering that question. But he felt privileged, and he was surprised to get the job. And the fact of the matter was that the Oceanographic was desperate for a crew. In fact, he was not the first ordinary seamen hired on, but the others had left because they were afraid of the third mate and the bosun. They couldn't take the pressure. So but he was driven to fulfill this dream. Again, captain's courageous, and he did that.
Now, we've talked a little bit about this shortage of crew because of World War II. And one of the stories I found really interesting, he talks about among the hardships on Atlantis and the aspects of the ship that were perhaps not designed with the crew in mind was the anchor windlass, that this took multiple men, every crank up and down got them one link of chain on board the ship. It could take them an hour or more to raise the anchor. And so sometimes they would actually manage to guilt technical and scientific crew into helping them. And for me, that just raised the question of how much communication or interaction really was there between these crewmen and the scientists and technicians that they were ferrying out to sea? I mean, were they essentially living completely different worlds at that point?
I think they were physically isolated on the ship in terms of living quarters and where they ate their meals and so forth and so on. They had to work alongside each other operating the gear and deploying the instruments, but
And I would say, however, that a lot of the design of the ship and the way it was operated came from Columbus Island's vision of what manly profession oceanography was. And it's said that he purchased the windlass that you referred to earlier from an ancient ship in Sweden. And the squarehead sailor said, well, that was old when we were kids. You know, but the idea of men cranking this machine appealed to Columbus Island, and he had done it himself. He was a special person, and so there wasn't really total separation at all. I mean, he knew how to sail a ship. He knew how to crank a crank. He did it. They would do it.
Right. He was a sailor himself.
Oh, yeah.
An excellent sailor.
Absolutely.
I guess, though, it does seem like there was this interesting dichotomy where Bill says that Woods Hole at that place was a place where you could get to know anyone and he does encounter all of these different people. And yet, at one point, he mentions that he doesn't even know what the sort of heads and sleeping arrangements were behind the mast where the scientific and technical staff would have been, that he didn't even venture into that part of the ship. So it still seems like there's this very strong class divide there somehow. But in his reminiscences, then it seems to break down that he is talking with the captain and with the scientists and with anyone he wants to in Woods Hole.
I think that's correct. But I believe there's still very significant separation between the people who are doing different jobs at the Oceanographic Institution. And I think it's less than it was then. But, the job that administrators have to do, the important work they have to do, is very different from what scientists have to do. And that's different from what ship operators have to do. And at the recent retirement of the NOR, it came across beautifully how coherent and interactive the captain and the crew, the mates, the engineers, and so forth, right down to the ordinaries and able-bodied seamen, how unified they were, how the strong bond they had among that group. And the scientists would come on board, and they deserve, of course, they deserve credit for what gets accomplished when they go to sea, but it's a totally different job from what the seamen have to do.
How different is that or not? I mean, you mentioned the retirement of the NOR. Jay Burnett, you've spent years going out on fisheries research vessels. And I have to say, as I was reading through this and hearing the stories of scrubbing the decks and wetting down the decks every day and just the routine of taking care of a ship, it made me stop and think, well, we talk about what it's like for the scientists who go to sea on modern research vessels and never hear about beyond perhaps the mention of the fact that the captain is excellent and the crew is very supportive. We don't hear about what it is that they're doing. Is the crew still doing on these modern ships all of these same things, scrubbing and painting and taking care of the ship every day?
To their dismay, they are. that technology has not improved those situations. There's just a lot of hard, dirty work that needs to be done on a daily basis on a ship. There's a lot of downtime on cruises. There's watch schedules, so people have time off, and you get to know the crew during those downtimes. There's common areas to sit and read, and I think that bonding creates a camaraderie. Each crew seems to have a specific tone to it. And chemistry.
As you read through Bill Cooper's memoirs, how much of what he was writing about his experiences, I mean, clearly the Atlantis, just as a primarily sailing vessel, this was a very different time in history and a very different experience. But how much of what he was writing resonated with you as, oh, yeah, that's kind of the same thing I experienced going out on boats in my career, and how much of it struck you as being really quite different?
I'd say it was quite similar. In the 80s, 1980s, we did have some of those squarehead sailors on board, and they were a delight. And there were a lot of similarities between the structure of the Atlantis with the more modern vessels. And I don't know how much that. Until you have robots doing the work, I don't know how that ever is going to seriously change.
Some things will always be the same on a research vessel. Yeah. All right. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking with Jay Burnett and Arthur Gaines about their new book, Atlantis Stories, Before the Mast on a Sailing Research Vessel. We will talk more about the science that took place aboard the Atlantis in the 1940s, the role that played in World War II, and where Bill Cooper and the Atlantis went after they parted ways in the late 40s. That's all coming up on Living Lab after a short break. Welcome back to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking today with Arthur Gaines and Jay Burnett, the editors of a new book, Atlantis Stories, Before the Mast on a Sailing Research Vessel. It's a collection of first-person reminiscences by Bill Cooper, who spent 4 years toward the end of World War II as an ordinary seaman on board Huey's first research ship, the Atlantis. Now, we were talking a little bit about the hardships of life aboard the ship and what drew Bill Cooper to this life. He never seemed deterred by the hardship. He seemed to really relish his time at sea, which had been a dream since boyhood. Was the fact that he was on board a ship that was doing science, was the importance of that science of any importance to him, or was that completely secondary? I mean, the science almost doesn't show up in the book.
That's right. I think Bill Cooper was mainly interested in going to sea and in learning about being a seaman and a sailor, and he didn't pay much attention to the science. Occasionally, well, in part because there was a separation between scientists and crew, especially crew members on the lower rungs of the ladder. But there were scientists on board, as there are now, who would be happy to explain what they're trying to do. And so Bill does have some parts in there about science, although the main scientific content of the book is what we have added as sidebars to try to put that perspective on the story.
I mean, at one point he describes Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution as, quote, off the wall, and it's just an off the wall place. And he said he really didn't understand much of what was going on anywhere. I mean, do you think that was because he didn't, you know, as you say, he didn't really care to understand that much, that it just kind of seemed like this off-the-wall arcane stuff that was going on and he was just going to go about his business? Or do you think he tried to understand it and it really just didn't?
I think that, Bill, you remember Bill Cooper was 17 when he came on board and he had not graduated from high school. So he didn't have any scientific background and he didn't come here to learn science. So but he was surprised that the organization seemed as casual and unstructured as it was. But, you know, I guess maybe outsiders see it that way. I've had people say, oh, it must be wonderful working at the Oceanographic. You know, people come to work in casual clothing and so forth. But the fact of the matter is it's a crucible. And you may dress that way, but people are on facing grants and contracts and writing and the success of those grants and contracts and pursuit of the tenure track or the absence of a tenure track. And it appears to be one thing from people just coming here or outsiders, but it's quite different for those who spend their lives here.
Well, so what was the science that Atlantis was doing while Bill Cooper was on board? I mean, it was the ships when he first went out, his first scientific cruise was actually Atlantis's first scientific cruise in almost 3 years toward the end of World War II, and they were working quite closely with the Navy. What was it they were actually trying to do?
Well, they started out, you know, the Oceanographic was founded in 1930, and the ship came in 31, and at that time, they saw oceanography as an academic science, and fisheries science, they studied the plankton chemistry. Early oceanographers worked on the chemistry of the ocean, and the idea that the Navy would become involved and sponsor research didn't come until close on to 1940. But Columbus Islin was very keen on the idea that oceanography could be very important in the national security and in the activities of the Navy. You know, the oceans are an important part of battle space, as they say, and to understand the battle space is key to conducting a battle. So Columbus Island pushed the use of the ship, and the first cruise was designated for the Bahamas. It was called the Tongue of the Ocean cruise. That was an interesting cruise. It was fascinating, in fact. They were studying basically the impact of depth charges on submarines, because apparently the U-boats were capable of diving much deeper than the Allies had thought. So they were detonating depth charges too shallow. And the purpose of the Tongue of the Ocean cruise was to explore the effect of greater depth and on the effectiveness of depth charging.
I mean, remembering, as you say, that this was a 17-year-old boy who was out there gives a different perspective, I think, when you read his memoirs. They're in the voice of someone quite mature, but I think that remembering that he was only 17, the thing that really struck him about that whole cruise, the only mention of the science, is really the fact that it was kind of exciting to have these depth charges being exploded essentially right beneath Atlantis, and the vibrations and the movement of the boat when those depth charges went off. That's really what seemed to grab his attention.
Sure, and the near accidents, too. I mean, some of them went off in the wrong place, and it was... It is... an interesting window into the early years of Navy work on the Atlantis.
A relationship that lasted several decades.
Absolutely. And yep. It became essential. In fact, the first crisis, as far as I know, that the institution faced, a very serious crisis, was when the war was over and the Navy wanted to pull out. And, you know, that had become the major source of funding for the work going on here.
Now, Atlantis has a nickname that has stuck over decades, the A-boat. Was that really just to play off the U-boats? And was that a nickname that came from this World War II era? Or is there some other derivation of that nickname?
I suppose it came from that era. Cooper never used that term through 1948. But in the 50s, that was how the ship was designated. And so all of the people who are still around now who think of Atlantis think of her as the A-boat.
And I was interested in reading his accounts and seeing the photographs that you include, just how much military there was in and around Woods Hole. And I mean, when you line it up, it's, oh yeah, that makes sense. Remember, you know, Camp Edwards and the Coast Guard, but there was also a huge Navy presence. I mean, that had to be a huge impact on the community and how the whole place around here functioned. It was like this end of the Cape was one big military base for a while.
It was, and there were checkpoints everywhere, and there are new checkpoints now, but there were crash boats operating here, and any number of there was the presence of young men in sailor suits and so forth was all around the village, more so than at present. You know, as Cooper said, the Woods Hole in those days was in a way simpler, but in a way more complete. You know, it had hardware stores, it had a barber shop, in addition to restaurants and these things, year-round restaurants. So it was, when you look at the aerial photographs, you see many familiar things. MBL had many of the buildings it has now, and fisheries buildings have all been replaced, but the Bigelow building was here. And but it was very active in the military, and of course the ships for the Murmansk run were put together as convoys in Buzzards Bay right off of here. Apparently there were some spy type activities in Woods Hole as well. We don't get into that, but I understand that's true.
Given the fact that Bill Cooper was ineligible to serve because of his bad leg, and the fact that there was so much military presence around, you know, Atlantis was playing an important part in anti-submarine research, in Navy research. Do you think he viewed this as a way that he could serve, or was that not anything that really ever entered his thinking about what he was doing? Did you get any perspective on that from his reminiscences?
He didn't say anything like that. I mean, I have added in reviews of the book that, in fact, he did serve an important function during the wartime years, but he didn't seem to mention that himself, and I don't think it was something he consciously thought about.
Now, Bill Cooper was only on the Atlantis for, as much as it seems like a very formative period in his life, for 4 years between the ages of, what, 17 and 21,
right,
and then went on to other things. But you have written that you felt like his final cruise was really a very special moment for him in his life. So tell us about that.
Well, the final cruise was called the Med Cruise. It was a cruise in the Mediterranean, and it was sponsored by the Navy. And the principal objective was to do surveys of the Aegean Sea leading to the entrance to the Black Sea, which is where the Cold War naval fleet of the Russian, the so-called Soviet Union, was coming together. But it was a very rough cruise, and it turned out to be his last cruise. And there a number of reasons, probably. I think he had learned what he thought he could learn. He sported a wedding ring on his left hand, ring finger.
He'd married
Judy Eldred, who,
right, the daughter of the owner of the Quissett Yacht Yard.
Right.
He says he has this premonition before he even met her, when he first heard her name, that somehow this was the woman he would marry. I mean, it's not even love at first sight. It's love at first hearing her name.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, there's a joke about marrying the daughter of someone who owns a liquor store. And in this case, this was even better for him, the daughter of a man who ran the local boatyard.
And it's interesting that he never mentions it in any of his memoirs, getting married. We were going through archival photographs and spotted a wedding ring on his hand when he was rowing one of the whaleboats.
That's true. He just simply goes from this premonition to a few years later, he's married.
He's married. And his wife, Judy, gave me the details of that. It was September 7th, 1947, they got married. And that became sort of, I think that became the focus of his interest. So on his last cruise in the Mediterranean, he had enough, and he was going to go out. And I tried to keep myself out of this book personally, but I couldn't resist this final sidebar on Bill Cooper leaving the Atlantis, if I may read that.
Absolutely.
Yeah, this is what I wrote, not Bill, called Moving On. On one of Atlantis's last port stops at Piraeus, the port of Athens, during the Med cruise, Bill and others made their way to Athens, where they were drawn to the Acropolis. This would be Bill's last cruise, and I think of this visit to the temple of Pallas Athena, goddess of knowledge, as Bill's commencement exercise. His cap and gown was the dress of the tenured able-bodied seaman. He had studied for 4 years with the masters, the squarehead seamen, in the classrooms of the wheelhouse, the forecastle, and the sea-washed deck. Perhaps one of the most important lessons he learned was not a nautical one, that your most important obstacles in life are often those you hold in your mind. Beyond that, many things are possible. Bill was ready to move on. He began his new journey by going home.
It's a beautiful end to that chapter of the story. What did Bill Cooper go on to once he got home here to Woods Hole?
Well, we did put an epilogue in the book, and part of it was written by Douglas Cooper, his father's life after coming back. He mainly was a small boat builder and designer. For a number of years, he worked in a shipyard in Connecticut building a wooden mine sweepers. He was a town council member,
town meeting member
in Falmouth for 20 years. His personality came out in many of those meetings. He was intolerant of any unfair treatment of people. He had his own sense of justice that goes right back to the squarehead seaman. You know, we see the same thing in those men. He had five children. He had a couple of ambitious ideas. One of the things he thought about was building ships of the future in segments so that the segments would have specialized functions. There would be one segment which was the power source of this chain of vessels. Another would have different functions, barges, whatever. And he promoted this idea, and he had a lawyer. He tried to patent the idea, but he ran out of money, and he had to end that. He had actually even built a scale model of this idea, which in the end piled up in his backyard, and some parts of it are still around, used for hauling moorings. But his wife, you know, they say that a healthy marriage includes some banter, and his wife Judy called this Cooper's folly, because it in the end it didn't work. But I should say, though, that the idea has taken hold in other ways. The so-called integrated tug barge (ITB), in which the barge fits in a notch, the tug fits in a notch in the barge. So it's actually two separate parts, the barge and the tug, and more lately the articulated tug barge, in which they're actually attached, but it's an attachment that can come apart. So his idea was a good one, but he didn't have the wherewithal to push it through.
Well, we will have links on our website and more information on how you can find this new book, Atlantis Stories Before the Mast on a Sailing Research Vessel. Our website is capeandislands.org. Jay Burnett, Arthur Gaines, thank you to both of you.
Thank you, Heather.
It's great being here.
Until next week, this is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab on the Point is produced by Heather Goldstone, with assistance from Jenny Junker and Alicia Orsini. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Major support for Living Lab is provided by the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment. Additional support is provided by Lee McGraw through the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. Living Lab is a production of WCAI, the local NPR station for the Cape, the Coast, and the Islands.